I feel after that introduction, I'm about to shut up because anything I do is going to make you feel less about me than okay. Hi. How many of you are Yavna parents? So I got a parking spot here tonight. That's a big deal. It's the first time in like 15 years that I got a parking spot at Yavna. I feel quite okay. It's a small group, so here's what I'd like to do. I'm going to speak, but I'd like you to interrupt me. If you feel really polite, you can raise your hand. If you don't, you can just call something out. It's okay. We should have some interaction. Let's start by having a sense of how many of you have kids who are under three? Three to four? Four to five? You're keeping your hand up the whole time. Okay. So this is an early childhood session, but we'll talk about kids of all ages. Just give me an idea. What brought you here tonight? What about resilience was something that you felt was something you wanted to learn about? Yeah. Okay.
Get through it and know that every child is overcomable, how to work through it, things like that.
Okay. A general sense. Well, it's interesting because for many years, books on parenting really talked about raising happy children, raising calm children, raising successful children. The last 20 years has been a lot of research on resilience. And the really talk is based on a sense that no person can avoid experiencing frustration, and no person can avoid experiencing disappointment or challenge or pain or loss or the need to make difficult decisions. And mostly, our difficult decisions are decisions that we make between two things that we value. It's really easy if you have given a choice between something really good and something really terrible. We all know how to do that. But it's really hard because that means that almost every important decision we make involves some loss because you have to give up something that it is that you really like. So, for example, I like living in Teaneck, but I really wanted to live in Israel. And I had to decide what. I'm doing both. But at some level, those are the kinds of things that one has to work on. Is feeling. So what is resilience? So I want you to stop. Think of someone that you can think of that you know who's resilient, that you would characterize as resilient. Just spend 10 seconds thinking about that person. If it's you, don't tell us. Just talk about it as if it's somebody else. What is it about that person that makes you characterize them as resilient? What is it? What do they do? What do you notice about them?
They're always positive.
Okay.
They roll with the punches. Like something that happens, like
with them. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay. Well, okay. So resilience really has two separate aspects to it. One is something we'd call stress hardiness, a person who can deal with stress and not almost take it in stride. And a lot of that is kind of built in. People are born with certain temperaments. How emotional you are, how intensely you experience your emotions, whether you're positive or negative, how you adapt to novel situations, how long it takes you to adapt, how easy it is to you to become routinized. All those things are kind of inborn. If you have more than one child, I would imagine that if you look at your children, you see that they're different. And they're not different they're different in part because you're different 2 years later, but they're also different because they're born that way, and there are certain things that are beyond our control. I think the illusion of parents being able to control their children is just that. It's an illusion. I mean, the best you can hope for is that you create conditions under which they control themselves. So stress hardiness is a part of resilience that we're kind of born with or not. But the second aspect is really something what we're really going to talk about more is helping children build inner strength to cope with the challenges and frustrations and even pain that's inevitable in life. And that includes the following kinds of topics, some of the things that you've said before. Managing stress and pressure, coping with everyday challenges, bouncing back from disappointment, becoming a problem solver rather than a complainer. And I say that again because we Jews love to complain. We love to complain about everything. I mean, how many people think school is great? I mean, there's a school professional here. You always complain about school. You always complain about the rabbi's speech. There's relating well to others and treating yourself and others with respect. And I hope we can begin to focus as a community, as parents, more on helping people respect them, on children's self-respect rather than self-esteem. Self-esteem is a concept I think that's it's important, but it's hard to really understand it, and it's been abused lately. It's sort of gotten to the point where everybody who shows up gets a trophy. Everybody's a winner. Everybody's great. You don't have to achieve anything in order to be told you're wonderful. Kid shows you the picture. Oh, it's the most wonderful picture I ever saw in my entire life. Because we've been told that we have to raise our children's self-esteem. And how do you do that? You tell them that they're great. No matter what, I see you set your brother's hair on fire. That was the best fire I've seen in a long time. So part of the self-esteem is really, self-esteem comes from real success. And real success, I don't mean you don't have to invent, you don't have to solve, you don't have to be Einstein. You don't have to invent a cure or come up with a cure for cancer to feel successful. But one of the things we have to do, and you really can help children become more resilient, is by focusing on self-esteem as resulting from success. What can I help my child do that they can be successful at, rather than the words of praise that you give them? Yeah.
School encourages us to send mixed notes to school.
Right.
I have 2 4-year-olds, and my girls are very excited about getting mixed notes.
Mm-hmm.
And they ask for them for routine things at home.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to make a difference between what is considered a mitzvah and what is considered just every day. Like, you know, the picture was beautiful. It wasn't Picasso. If you don't make that distinction, will they walk around thinking they're the best?
Well, it's really interesting. I'll get to it later. There was really interesting research this person named Waller, I think from Harvard, has done on took a whole bunch of 5-year-olds and their mothers, individually, 5-year-olds and their mothers in a room and had them play, and gave them an unstructured task just to play and then structured task to play, and then they characterized, it was mothers and a few fathers, but it was mostly mothers, characterized the mothers' responses as either critical of the children's behavior, as just reflecting, oh, I see you made a tower, or as praising, it's a wonderful tower. Look at that, that's really a tower. Okay, the easy one first. What did kids dislike the most?
Criticism.
So when mothers were critical, kids really disliked the interaction. They felt bad. They were unhappy, and they didn't feel good about it. Which did mothers like the least?
Good.
Same situation. When they felt that that the kid wasn't doing well and they had to criticize their behavior, mothers liked it the least. But now let's do the other way. In which circumstance were the children, did the children report being happiest and most satisfied? The reflection. When parents reflected what children were doing, children expressed the most satisfaction with their own work, the most happiness with the interaction. Which were the mothers most? Which condition, under which condition were the mothers most happy? Yes, exactly right. So here we have a conflict in needs. Parents, not just mothers, feel great when they can say, oh my God, you're wonderful. Because they really feel that the kids, you know, it's great to feel your kid is wonderful. Kids take it in different ways, because what's happening is it means that when I do something, my parent is responding with a judgment. And one day I can be great, and another day I might not be great, but that helps lead to a sense of I'm either great or not great. No, we're going to say our kids are wonderful because they're our kids and they're wonderful, because they're also a reflection of us and we're wonderful, so they must be wonderful. But it's really important, one of the things to begin to think about is how do we praise? And in what way, and in fact, do we need to respond to our children's behavior with a judgment? When they're doing something wrong, it's important to let them know. But when they're drawing a picture, providing interest, responsiveness, engagement is a way to help them, that kids feel you've paid attention to them. And you notice what they were doing. And that's the most important thing to start with. And if they really want to know if you like it, they'll ask you, do you like it? Yes, I like it. And this is what I like. I like this part of the picture. Now, with the mitzvah note, depends what the culture of mitzvah notes is. Is there competition in school? Who gets the most mitzvah notes? Is there an implication that if you don't bring a mitzvah note, that means you get an implied avera note? I'm not sure.
You're supposed to fill up the tree. There's a space that they fill up on a regular basis. So
this is a perfect example for how you help kids deal with this, because then you have a discussion with your children of, well, what does a person have to do to get a mitzvah note? If you swallow your dinner, is that a mitzvah note? Is a mitzvah note anytime they comply with your request, since kibud av va'em is a mitzvah? And if you say, please clear your plate, and they did the mitzvah of kibud av, is that included? I don't know. There's no right answer to it. But it's an interesting discussion to have with your child about setting expectations, making life somewhat predictable, letting them know you're ready to hear their opinion about it, but that you're really going to decide, and that you're clear about what the expectations are. First of all, that helps reduce disappointment, but also helps them believe that the world is fair, and it also helps them see that you're willing to live with their disappointment. If they want a mitzvah note for everything, and you say, that's not the way we're going to do it, and that, I mean, brings up the question of, can you live with your child's disappointment? If you want your child to be resilient, first thing is, you need to accept that as a goal. If your goal is that your child is going to be happy, then there will be a tendency, there's nothing wrong with happiness, I'm not against happiness. I mean, it takes away from my business, I understand, but I'm not against happiness. I'm very, really want kids to be happy. If your goal is if you want the child to be happy, you run the risk of trying to avoid letting them experience uncomfortable emotions or uncomfortable experiences. If your goal is to have your child become resilient, then you want them to build inner strength and to have them deal with what life brings them, and if it brings them something that's not so much fun, okay, but you believe that they can deal with it. It's not a betrayal of their basic rights as a human being to have to be frustrated. And we'll get into it a little bit in a minute. So we get back to that reflecting and describing what kids are doing. I learned, even when a child's doing something wrong, I learned a very interesting lesson. I was in a room with my son, who's now 28 and would probably be embarrassed and has two kids of his own, hearing this story. But we're sitting in a room somewhere. He had to go someplace for tests, and there's a doctor and a nurse there, and there were toys on the side, and he was banging. And of course, my response was, inner response was to tell him to stop it. And the nurse said, Eitan, that banging is making it hard for us to have a conversation. And he looked at her, and he stopped. It was a tremendous lesson for me, in that so often, even when we're trying to teach our children lessons, we try to give them the answer. We do too much work. We do too much emotional work. We do too much talking. And I learned a tremendous lesson then. By describing the situation, many children will get the implication. And what are you doing? You're describing the situation as you see it. You're giving your child the opportunity to interpret what your intentions are, to make the decision on their own what to do, and to show you that they can make a decision to be a moral person and to do the right thing. Which is really different than saying, cut it out, okay. So although being compliant is an important skill, it's still helping a child decide what to do at the moment is really, yeah.
What happens if you say to your child, you know, that your banging is making it difficult for us to have a conversation, and then you just don't care, right? If you said, stop it, you will have, pushed the value.
So, you know, you always maintain the right to say, I need you to stop. Right? But if you start by describing the situation and your distress at it, you have an opportunity to see whether your child will respond. And it doesn't take away your right afterwards to say, I know you want to bang, but if you want to bang, please go over there, or bang more softly, or I'm sorry, we can't bang now, so I'm going to take that away if you don't stop. Or even please stop. You always have a right to do those things. But one of the things we're trying to build in here is helping children make decisions to do the right thing without their sole decision to be, do I listen to mom and dad or do I not listen to mom and dad? By engaging them in the process of helping them decide on what the right thing to do is. Now, one of the most important things to do, which is really sounds silly to say it, is to be present. But it's not that silly. It's hard to parent if you're not there. But more than that, when you are there, to really be there. I worked with a family once, and a child would always complain, we never do anything together. It was only child. We never do anything together. We never do anything as a family. My parents are always working. And the parents said, what are you talking about? We go out to dinner every Sunday night. I walked into a local restaurant, and there was this family. So, of course, I walked out of that restaurant. But in the moment I was there, there was the family, a child trying to engage his parents in conversation, and each of the parents on their Blackberries. Anybody with a Blackberry, if you have your Blackberry in your hand, you're not with your child. No matter what you think you're doing, it doesn't work. If you check your email, then your child thinks that you're interested in their email, not in you. Being psychologically present is one of the first things and most important things that a person can do. In our world, that's not so. I mean, does anybody ever face this challenge of feeling that there's so many other things pulling them that being with a child is a hard thing to do? So, how do you get over it? There's only one thing to do is really put the BlackBerry away and not answer the phone. How many times is there a phone call that you take when you're trying to be with your child that really, really was essential and you couldn't get away, you couldn't deal with not, it would have been wrong to give it up? I don't know, in my life, not that many phone calls that I really have to take at the moment that I couldn't have taken an hour later. But once you're present, one of the most important things is to be able to understand that you have to give your kids permission to feel uncomfortable emotions. An interesting thing happened to me today watching, we're on the floor in my son's living room, and my 2.5-year-old grandson is trying to put something together, and he's frustrated, and he gives a little growl of frustration. And his mother, my daughter-in-law, who's really wonderful, just waited, and then he got frustrated even more, and really, and she said, I see you're frustrated. Take a deep breath. When we get frustrated, we take a deep breath, and then we try again. Now, that happened today. I wasn't talking about this anyway, but look at that story. She didn't think it was terrible that he was frustrated. She didn't convey to him that it was terrible that he was frustrated. She didn't step in to soothe him by saying, it's okay. She didn't take away the object from him to have him do something else. She didn't do it for him. She labeled the emotion. She let him know it was okay to have the emotion. And she gave him some idea about how one deals with the emotion. And that's one of the things we have to do. If a child is anxious about something, okay, so you're worried. It's okay to be worried. What are the hardest emotional experiences for you to let your child? Which emotions are difficult for you to let your child have? Do you intervene quickly and say, it's okay, Tatala, I'll take care of it? When does that happen for you?
Pain.
Sorry?
Pain.
What kind of pain?
Pain?
Okay, so interesting research. Children who fall, and their mothers are in the room, cry 3 or 4 times as much if children fall and their mothers are not in the room. Fathers as well. Look at parents who respond to their children when they fall and immediately run to them, their children begin to cry. And parents who stop and say, are you okay? Their children will look, and sometimes will cry and sometimes will not. So even in those moments of pain, our responses can affect our children's responses. And I don't know if you have young children. Often children, when they fall, the first thing they'll do will look to a parent to see what the parent's response. If you go, they start to cry. And if you stay calm. Because one of the messages that you're giving your child and helping your child become more resilient is, you're going to be okay. I'm okay. I'm okay with this, and you're going to be okay. I'm okay with this doesn't mean that I'm happy that you're really having a tantrum. And I'm okay with this doesn't mean that I'm enjoying the fact that you're in pain. It means that I'm strong enough to take this, and your difficult emotion is not going to knock me off my equilibrium. As especially with stormy emotions like rage or anxiety that can ignite our own rage and our own anxiety. The most important thing you can try to learn to do is to physical pain, wait and see. If you have a kid who falls, looks at you, and you're calm and look at them, and then they learn to stay calm, when they fall and hurt themselves, you'll know. Because when kids who don't cry all the time fall and hurt themselves, they cry. And that's not common for them. But for kids who fall, and no matter what they do, you know, they go like this. And then you come and you call and hold them. And if you're involved in soothing your child intensely for minor events, it's time to take a step back and say, wait, does she really need this, or does he really need this? And is there something else I can do? Because one of the goals that you have to take on is helping a child become a self-soother rather than only depending on the parent to soothe them. The problem with that is, if we're not soothing our kids, what's our job? It feels good to take care of your kid and to soothe your child. So giving it up is not so simple. So one issue is physical pain. Anything else? What are the things that you have found has been hard to let your child go through? Yours or his? Oh, okay. No, I'm kidding. I was going to say. Okay. For example.
I should give an example?
If you don't mind. You don't have to.
Even between like a play date and things can become very heated up. Like, I've struggled. Obviously before they hit each other.
Mm-hmm.
But when do you step in? How do you step in? What's the lesson to be learned? And how you can make it a positive lesson in that rage?
Mm-hmm. Well,
do you just calm them down, sit them down? Do you?
But what's the problem? The problem is not the rage. The problem that they're dealing with is something that happened before then. Is a difficulty. Part of the question is, when you have a kid who gets very angry, is it's very hard not to try to quash it, not to try to shut it down. And it's very important to be able to help your child understand that your rage won't destroy me. I'm going to be okay, and you're going to be okay too. Because first, I'm going to be okay. Inside, you might be falling apart, and you might have to, once it calms down, leave the room to go cry, call your husband, call your mother, call your friend, do whatever you do to calm down. But at the moment, it's important to be able to give the message, calmly say, we're going to deal with this. And his rage is not going to set you off. The question is, what's before then? Usually when you see a kid become enraged, there's some process. And can you predict what that process is going to be? And can you help them see their pattern? Shlomo's coming over. And whenever Shlomo comes over and he wants to play with your Power Rangers, I'm not sure they'll play with those, or rescue heroes, you always fight over what he can touch or not touch. And then you go, man, I'd rather you have a nice play date, so let's figure out which can he touch and which can't he. So part of the work in helping them is predicting. Because resilient people predict. And they also learn their patterns. I get nervous talking in front of adults. I'm a child psychologist for a reason. But I know that when I start that, once it's over, I'm okay. So And that, so one of the things that people do in order to help them deal with uncomfortable situations, they learn from their experience. Children need help learning from their experience. And part of the parent's job is to help predict. So if you can predict where it goes wrong, that's important. Once they get mad, it's really important for you to stay calm. The parent who says, "I told you not to hit your brother when you get angry," is giving a very different, very unhelpful message. By the way, losing your temper is a fine parenting tool if you do it once every month or two. Rage is a horrible parenting tool if you lose your temper often, because what kids learn is, "Dad has a problem." So it's really important to try really to stay calm, and again, to let them see, "I understand, part of the message is, I'm me, and you are you. You have your feelings, and I have my feelings, and I can help you, because I know it's going to be okay." And the other part of the message is, intense feelings come, and then they go. They may come back again, we don't have to tell them that right now, but you'll feel better. It'll be okay. Once a kid gets angry, to help them label their anger, "I see you're very angry. Do you know what's making you angry? Do you want to stay angry? Because if you don't want to stay angry, I can help you try to be less angry. Let's try to calm down first, because it's really hard to solve problems when someone is very, very in a state of high arousal. Let's try to calm down first." And teaching for resilience means it's okay to be angry, but you have some choices to make now. I can help you with them, and your anger is not going to set me off. And trying to help them see what their patterns are. Another thing is there's psychologists who call something in dealing with frustration positive frustration. It's really important to know whether the situation that you've helped, that you've put your child in, can it provides them with the right amount of frustration. Can the child really manage this? If you tell a kid, sure, 3 years old, "Want to learn to tie your shoelaces," they're not going to learn to tie their shoelaces. And no matter how calm and supportive and you are in dealing with their frustration, it's unlikely they're going to learn to do that. So if you feel like this play date is something that the child can do, you have to figure out where it goes wrong and then help them learn from their pattern. And being positive is part of it. I'm giving the message that it's going to be okay. So anything else? What other emotions are hard?
Yeah.
Anxiety. Again, can you give an example?
In an older child, it could be something like, "I left my books, at school, and oh my God, I'm going to fail my test, and what am I going to do, and blah, blah, blah." Because one of the parents may say, "Oh, let me go to school and get your books for you."
Mm-hmm.
I don't think fosters resilience.
Okay.
So that's one example. And another could just be anxiety, like, what am I going to do? All my friends are going here, but I'm going there, and if I'm not going to be with them, then what am I going to do? When I'm a loser, that kind of anxiety.
So again, part of the challenge here is being able to separate, take a step back, and to stay calm in the face of that, and to be able to understand that the child's feelings are not yours, and to say, you can disagree with them, but not tell them that they don't feel that way. So part of the challenge is giving kids permission to feel lousy. If I felt that my friends were avoiding me, I would also feel bad. But I don't think that's what your friends are doing. So the way I see it, I think you're overreacting. But if you feel bad about this, then you feel bad about this.
So you're not supposed to take away their anxiety by saying, "I don't understand why you're feeling..."
No, you can. I know you're feeling anxious about this. I know you're feeling... But you do need to help them question if you think they're making an interpretation of the facts which is unrealistic. And you help them, but if they're going to feel, it's important to let them know they can feel anxious. Listen, one of the issues that always often comes up is the issue of dealing with death. Do you take kids to funerals? do you tell them about? What does someone die? There's certain experiences in life that are supposed to feel bad. So I worked with a family who, what they decided to do when their dog died, and their kids had known their dog all their life, was they went to a dog psychic who, they bought a dog that looked exactly like the other dog. They went to a dog psychic who then channeled the spirit of the dead dog into the new dog so that the family, their children, could relate to the new dog as if it were the old dog, as if he didn't die. Sorry, that's what you're going to do?
No.
Okay. Well, there's a family who was saying, this is such a terrible experience that we can't, really what they were really saying consciously was, we can't bear the thought of you dealing with that loss. The implication, it comes from a protective place. We want to protect our children from having to deal with difficult emotions. The unintended consequences that you're saying is, we don't believe that you're strong enough to deal with this. We don't believe that you can really manage to adapt to the loss, and we aren't strong enough to see you sad about the death of your dog. Alternatively, is another family, a child came home, and they came home from a weekend away, and the child's hamster was in the throes of death. Now, you could tell when hamsters are dying because they kind of shrivel up, and the parents and the child wanted just to run away and tell the parent, just deal with it, and they decided that we're going to do this together. This is your hamster, and you raised it, and now it's dying and it needs you, so let's do this together. And it was an 8-year-old girl. It was very hard for her, but it was a life-changing experience. Because the child who felt she couldn't deal with anything was able to get through an experience with her parents sitting next to her, helping her, you know, do what she needed to do until the hamster died. And then she felt like, if I could nurse my hamster through and watch it die, then I can do anything. No, it's not really true that you can do anything. But it was an experience in which the parents helped her see that they believed she was strong enough to deal with this loss. And they helped her get through it. It's the same, similar issues with going to funerals. You know, if a grandparent dies, do you bring your, I think you bring kids to funerals unless you think the funeral is going to be so out of control emotional that what they'll see at the funeral is going to be just traumatic, and therefore it's not. They need explanations, they need preparation, they need to have someone sitting with them, they need to have the opportunity to leave if it's not right, they need to be in a place where if they're end up talking about some irrelevant detail that the rest of the mourners won't be upset about it. There's things you need to do, but the idea of protecting them from an experience of being with their family to mourn the loss of someone who was important to them, I think is a mistake. And that's we most of the things we do that work against kids being resilient are things that are done out of a need to be protective, and as opposed to anything else, but sometimes that works against us. Any other questions? Yeah.
You recognize traumatic things for people. Previously, we're talking about blade aids and hurting and things like that. But what about real trauma for the kids? A parent died, they have a terminal illness, you know, something like that. Those are obviously, you know, another bag of worms, but what is the general logic to get a kid to be resilient given a very traumatic situation?
The first thing is, it's really important to understand that there's no words and no actions you can do to make this easy. And so we have this thought that if we were good parents, we'd make our children's lives easy. And this example sort of brings it up. There are certain experiences in life that there's nothing you can do to make it easy. What you can do is try to make it a little bit more manageable. And depending on what the if there's a traumatic experience, one of the things you try to do is to provide support so the children are not overwhelmed. You try to help them be with people, again, depending on what the experience is. And to have them Again, is it a sudden experience? Is it a series of a chronic illness that where a person is slowly dying? But you know, that becomes help. First thing I would say, you can't make it easy, but hiding it from the child is not going to help. The question is, what?
Be totally on.
Well, being totally on, what sense does that mean?
Age appropriate.
You have to, so that a child of four does not really understand what death is. Four-year-olds kind of think you come back. And five-year-olds may know you don't come back, but they don't really believe it. Death happens to everybody. You know, death happens to those people. Not so that part of the challenge is trying to tailor your explanation to the person who's there in front of you. And five-year-olds are very different from each other. So, but yeah, helping them understand on some level what's happening. Daddy is very sick. He has something called, let's say, just something called cancer. And you have to try very hard to be positive about the efforts that are being made. We're trying to give him the best doctors that we could find him to see if we could help. And depending on your theology, and we're going to be praying to God to see what can do. But again, if you probably with a five-year-old, they wouldn't say he's going to die unless it's imminent. But the details of the situation would really depend on what you would say. But I would say telling people, because anticipatory anxiety and anticipatory mourning helps soften the blow of later mourning and of later. If you know something's going to happen, kid's going to have surgery. You tell them what's going to happen. As much as you know what's going to happen, you take them through the process. Don't tell them the doctor's going to take a knife and slice it into you and the blood's going to come out. That's going to happen too. You have to choose what you're going to say. But the parts of their experience. You're going to go into the hospital and I'm going to be with you and I'll be holding your hand and they're going to put something over your mouth, over your, whatever they're going to do. And you're going to breathe it in. It's going to smell like flowers and you're going to tell them what's going to happen. And then you'll wake up and I'm going to be right next to you. And then your tonsils will be out. And you're going to have a sore throat for a week, and you have to eat lots of ice cream, so what flavors do you want? And you try to help prepare them to make life as predictable as you can make it, even though in a traumatic situation, some things are not predictable. And sometimes it's not the parent who can do it. Because in the case, God forbid, of a parent who dies, then the other parent is often not in the emotional state to be able to present that information to their child because they have their own trauma and their own loss to deal with. So I think we can speak more specifically about something if you want to speak, not in front of the whole group, but I think that it's really important to be able to not hide what's happening from the child. I forgot to ask people to turn off their cell phones. One other thing that we have about 8 minutes left. So I said one more thing that's really important to deal with in terms of helping kids develop resilience is helping them take responsibility, which you're raised up with anxiety about schoolwork, but I want to put it within the rubric of taking responsibility. Kids make mistakes. Kids don't always succeed. And that's okay. If a child forgot his homework in school, why did you forget your homework in school is really not a relevant question. What's he going to say? Because I wanted to really bother you? Because they didn't want to do it? There's nothing they could say. What you can do is offer them the options that they really have. So, do you want to get your homework done or don't you? Now, if a child doesn't want to do their homework, I wouldn't offer them the option of not doing it. But if you think your child is upset about it, so what can we do? I'm not driving you to school. But there are other options. How are you going to get your homework? You can either do the homework tomorrow night, and we can write a note to your teacher, or you can call your friend, or you can get a foul, however else they can solve the problem. And whatever it is, it'll be okay. You're going to have to be responsible. You forgot your homework, so I'm not driving because you forgot your homework. Yeah.
So is reassurance okay in building resiliency?
Sure, it depends on how you reassure the child. So in this case, reassurance is essential in the sense of believing in a positive future. So whatever it is, we'll get through it. Whatever.
That feeling that I can get through anything, reassurance is helpful.
It's very important, but it depends on what. Don't worry, I'll do it. You didn't do your book report? Don't worry, I'll do it when you're sleeping. You'll have it in the morning. It's not the right kind of reassurance. I mean, I got through elementary school that way, but it didn't really help me when I actually had to write. I'd say, this is too hard. My mother said, oh, come on, that's really tough. You really have to do a book report. I don't really want to. Okay, fine, I'll do it. So, you know, once you give into that, and people do that, then it's hard to get out of that. And people do that in subtle ways. Kids have to take responsibility. If you did their homework, homework's an easy example in dealing with this. Child does his homework, he does it incorrectly. Now he did the wrong thing. Parents' job is to help children understand what they're supposed to do. You did a math page, you got it wrong. Okay, so you got it wrong, so fine. I'll go to school, his teacher will tell him I got it wrong, he'll teach him how to do it right, and he'll do it again. You don't have to make him present himself as perfect to the world. So, he forgot his homework, I can help you solve the problem, but it's your problem, not mine, I'm only here to help you. And if we can't figure out a solution, the ultimate solution is you'll go in with a note to the teacher and it'll be okay. But she'll be mad. Okay, so she'll be mad.
But you can say today, you can take that note, your kid is perpetually not bringing home his textbook. I mean, shouldn't he have to deal with the anger of the teacher? You've been irresponsible. Go deal with it.
Well, it depends what the problem is. So if a child is continually forgetting his textbook, they have to wonder what's going on that he's continually forgetting his textbook. If a child has a problem with memory and organization, and you're asking him to do more than he can manage, then forgetting his textbook is a sign that we're asking him to do something he can't really do. And if a child is forgetting his textbook because he really doesn't want to do it and he thinks he'll get away with it, then you have a different problem. So it depends what the problem is. But if a child... I don't think there's anything wrong with telling your child, I think it's right, actually, to have your child face the teacher and say, I forgot my work, but I'll do it today if I can. And hopefully the teachers they have to face will be understanding of the notion that people make mistakes and you can fix them. And if you have a teacher who's not like that, then that's a problem. But let's assume that teachers are good people and that they really do want children to grow. And that's so holding children responsible for their own behavior is very important. And then it goes into learning what a real apology is. I'm sorry is not an apology. I'm sorry is a cultural skip for, is it over now, Mom? That's what I'm sorry is. A real apology is, I did whatever. I feel bad about doing whatever. And I'd like to do something to make it better. Now, with younger kids, you start with, you know, some statement of remorse and some act of repair. Because part of taking responsibility is also repairing some of the damage that you made. You hurt your brother, help your brother feel better. Saying, I'm sorry, doesn't really do much. Helping your brother feel better is something that you can help a child learn to do, to take responsibility for their behavior without focusing on how much to blame they are. You can really help them focus on how to fix things rather than just how to blame. And one of the things that happens is not taking responsibility. Again, I'm working with a family. I just had a conversation last week with a parent of a teenager, and I had this ridiculous conversation in which and I work with many parents who they really want to help their child take responsibility, and they see the child is struggling with something, and they really do want. And I work with some other people who just continually find excuses for why their children didn't do the right thing. So I had this ridiculous conversation in my mind with the parent trying to explain why the reason why the child failed the drug test is because he's using drugs. Because that's the reason you fail drug tests. For the most part, it's not because you're in a room with people using drugs and their drugs somehow got into your bloodstream. So, but the point is, if you don't start now by holding a child responsible and saying, you made a mistake, it's okay, you still have to, not, it's okay, Tatala, don't, it's okay, you made a mistake, let's fix it. And if we work, and if we can work on, and the biggest fixing is in relationships. There's, you said something that hurt your brother's feelings. What can we do to make him feel better? You made a mistake, let's fix it. Because one of the things that happens then is that people learn to take responsibility for their own behavior. I mean, there's all this research on resilience, and everybody has their top 10 list of traits that are resilient. So if you, I try to make a list of them, there's like 90 of them. So, but one thing that everybody talks about is being optimistic about the future, being positive, feeling that you're capable of tolerating uncomfortable emotions and distress, and taking responsibility for your own behavior. People who take responsibility for their own behavior without beating themselves up end up feeling okay, because they're not afraid to say, I made a mistake. Because when you make a mistake, this is one thing the Catholics got right, when you make a mistake, confession is cleansing. When you make a mistake that you're embarrassed about, most people want to hide it. And that's the worst thing you can do in order to feel better. To feel better, it's much easier just to say, hey, I made this mistake. And it's remarkable how much easier your life is when you say that. And I think many of our kids don't realize that. We have 5 minutes, so I'm going to stop for this. I just want to say once, end with one little story. I don't really know the source of it, but there's this, it's a parable. A king who had a beautiful ruby. Rubies are red, right? Ruby, I told you about it. And he kept tried to keep it pristine. And it was without blemish for many years, and then one day he walked in and saw a scratch in it. And his initial response was to try to get people, all the jewelers, to come by to see if they can get the scratch out. And nothing worked. Until one person came in, took the ruby, and then used the scratch to carve a rose, used as a stem of a rose and carved a rose. And that's our job as parents. Our job as parents is not to keep our jewels of children pristine and without scratches. That's not possible. But you can turn their lives into something of beauty even with scratches, and even perhaps based around the scratches that they have, and help them grow into strong, beautiful, wonderful people. Anyway, so thank you very much. Good night.